This past weekend, the Kansas City Civic Orchestra had its first concert of the season featuring guest soloist Keith Stanfield on violin. Keith has an interesting story, which I know because he sent it to me in an email. I hope you don't find this presumptuous, the message begins. He goes on to explain that he's a violinist who used to play soccer at an international level for Western Samoa, his mother's country. But he retired from the sport because he was having to practice his instrument in an abattoir. That is a one-room shed with dead pigs hanging on hooks. I've since learned more about Keith. He started playing the violin when he was 3. He made his stage debut at 6 and his first television appearance on the BBC at 9. He recently returned to the violin thanks to a chance encounter in a Kansas City restaurant. But we'll get to that. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And today's show is a portrait session with Keith Stanfield. Hi, Keith.
Hello.
Let's start at the beginning, shall we?
Sure.
You were born in London. Tell me about your upbringing and your family.
Right. Well, first of all, thank you very, very much for having me on here. It's a great honor to be here. My mother's from Western Samoa. I think she's also half Indian. But she's from Western Samoa, which is a small island in the South Pacific. My father's from Australia, from Melbourne. I think they met on a bus in New Zealand. And my father was an artist, so I think he wanted to come to study classical art at an art school in London, and they decided to stay there, and that's where I was born.
They met on a bus? Do you know any more details than that?
Yeah, as far as my Samoan auntie tells the story, basically, my mother and my auntie were looking for a seat on this bus to go from one, I think, Auckland to Wellington or something like that. And there were no sort of seats available. And my auntie said, well, there's a seat next to that scruffy guy over there. So you can just go and sit there. And I think that's how it all began.
So your dad's that scruffy guy over there?
Yes, actually. And now that I've mentioned that, that really does fit. Yeah, that's true.
Tell me more about him.
Well, he's an artist. I think he's in Australia now, but he was very much into sort of traditional art, and he sort of stubbornly refused to paint or draw in a style that resembled anything after the 1800s. he was an interesting man, and he used to make me draw. I really liked to do it, but he made me learned to draw by copying a lot of old master drawings. I had all these books. One of them was by an American professor called Beverly Hale, I think, which is a fantastic book. But all throughout my childhood, I remember just copying Leonardo da Vinci and Raphael's. And I remember at the time, I would always try to cover up some of the nudity, and he thought that was absolutely hilarious. So I would put like some underwear on a male figure, and he thought it was absolutely ridiculous. I don't know. I was like 6 or 7, so...
Tell me about the London of your childhood, just through your own eyes.
Well, I was very, very lucky to go to a really nice elementary school called St. Philip's School. And it was, it still is in South Kensington in London. And it's run by this church called the Brompton Oratory. And it really did teach me sort of everything I needed to know, I feel, for social interaction, how to behave in society and how to sort of conduct yourself. The school had 99 students, and every time I look back on that education, I really am very grateful for it, because all of the fundamentals for life and civility were really hammered in at that school. I mean, anytime anyone came into a classroom, well, for a start, there was a uniform. We had a uniform and we had these sort of turquoise blazers. It sounds terrible. Actually, if you sort of go on the website, I think it looks quite cool. And, you know, we had to call the teacher sir, and we all called by our last names. And if you've seen Harry Potter, it's really basically like that without the magic. I mean,
and with turquoise.
Yes. But we had to stand up every time, behind our chairs, every time someone came into the classroom. There was a very sort of strict but merciful atmosphere. And these lessons were incredibly valuable.
Was being the child of immigrant parents a big part of how you grew up in London?
Well, it's interesting you mention that, because, you know, I obviously that's an issue that's sort of in people's minds a lot over here. And when I first moved to Kansas City, it was strange to see how those sorts of issues are much more sort of present in people's minds. I mean, London has, I think, nearly 10 million people, and Greater London, I think, has closer to 20. So growing up in that environment, you don't really see nationalities. You see sort of people as being from parts of London. So, I mean, there's always some sort of, you know, human beings will always make some kind of division. We're unfortunately very good at that as a civilization. However, it's not that you would see someone of a particular race and think, oh, they're from this race. They'll be, oh, he's a South Londoner. He's always going to behave like this. Or, oh, he's from North London. You know, it's such a diverse cultural melting pot that you don't even recognize accents anymore. It's just all which part of London are you from.
So when did the violin enter the story for you?
When I was 3.
Tell me that story.
Well, I was watching a concert on TV with my parents, and Itzhak Perlman was playing with an orchestra. I don't know what it was, and I don't think, well, they're not musical, so my parents wouldn't have any idea. And I saw the performance, and everyone was clapping at the end, and obviously he's a phenomenal talent, and I really wanted to do the same thing. So I asked my parents if...
Was it the violin playing or the clapping?
Oh, it's always both. I mean, I think people choose the violin for the instrument and the clapping. Yeah, so, yeah, but no, I mean, the violin's a fantastic instrument. He was just flying around, and he always does, you know, if you ever watch any of his performances, he's an incredibly entertaining performer and a very charming player. And so I was totally hooked. And fortunately, I asked my parents if I could play the violin, and they said yes. And so.
So at 3, you have, you know, you're inspired by kind of like one of the great violinists of our time, but that's not anywhere close to the sound a violin makes when someone first starts to play it. You were 3, and that is pretty young. Do you remember your early experiences with the violin?
I don't know if I remember specifics, but it's funny you should mention, yes. I mean, it's always said that the parents of violin students are very, very brave, because it's an incredibly difficult instrument to play, and one that even still, unfortunately, I've sort of yet to master. So, yeah, it sounds terrible at the beginning. I mean, it sounds absolutely awful.
I played the violin when I was really, really young, and I played it really badly, and I still remember what that sounded like. Honestly, I remember this makes a terrible screeching when you do it wrong.
Well, I mean, luckily I started with the Suzuki method, so that sort of accelerated that process a little bit.
Can you explain what that is?
Sure. The Suzuki method is a method of learning the violin that was started by Dr. Suzuki, who's a Japanese violinist. And it's really a phenomenon. I mean, he started in a very sort of small way in the, the middle of the 20th century. And it's a way of basically teaching music, and initially the violin, through ear, through sound, and getting, it's a very holistic process. It gets children to think about music in a very wholesome way, and to connect it with your emotions and think your way through music rather than sort of learn by sight reading.
Do I understand also that you don't actually handle the instrument from the beginning, like that you learn the instrument without the instrument at first?
Yes, this is something that my son, who's just turned 3 and has just started himself, is finding out, much to his great frustration. He really, really loves playing, but he's just started Suzuki, and he has to go to the foam violin, and he never misses an opportunity to tell his teacher how frustrating it is, in his own words. So, yes, you have a foam violin, and it's all about sort of the way you do it first before going ahead and executing. And frankly, it's really for the best. I mean, if you can start off something doing it the right way, it's a lot easier to progress and improve than if you have to sort of undo certain things and try to relearn a new process.
You performed on stage at the Royal Festival Hall when you were 6.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Well, I mean, it's just one of those things that, you know, if you do Suzuki and you're committed as a student and you enjoy playing, that it's an opportunity that you can receive if you work hard and if you're a little bit lucky, and I guess I was. it's a very large hall. I can't remember what I played, but at that sort of age, you don't really take any of these things into account. You just go and do it. It's just another sort of concert. And that's sort of the attitude I've tried to sort of carry forth. But yeah, it was just sort of part of the progression path of a person who wanted to play the violin. You work hard, you do a sort of audition to play in the concert, it goes well, and you play the concert, and then you do the next concert. And that was just sort of, it was a nice moment, but it was just sort of part of the natural life of someone who wants to play professionally.
And but when you say that's a large hall, I mean, it seats thousands, right?
Yeah.
What was that like for you at that age? Do you remember it?
Yeah, I sort of do. I mean, you go on the stage and, you know, it's really not that bad. I mean, it's far worse. Nowadays, not so much. But I remember when I was a child, especially when I was at the Purcell School of Music, it's much worse to play to four people who know you really, really well than to 4,000 people who have no idea who they are. That's much, much worse, because if you know your audience intimately and you're inexperienced, it can be very intimidating. But if you don't know anyone in the audience, you've done your preparation, and you enjoy doing what you're doing fundamentally, then it should be pleasurable.
You ended up on TV when you were 9. How did that happen? That seems a little less of like you go through the steps, you progress as you should, and you end up here at this concert.
Well, I think everyone enjoys a bit of luck every now and then. It was the same sort of situation. Frankly, it sort of was part of the sort of natural progression path. I mean, if you are trying to work in, the musical entertainment business, and you keep on progressing and keep trying to improve, it just so happens, I think, that you start to get a bit of good fortune, someone hears you play or something. I mean, you never really know the total specifics of anything. So I think at this time, I came to my lesson one time and my teacher said, okay, so there's this BBC show that they want sort of a young child to play this this Christmas song on this TV show. And I didn't really know much about it. I didn't watch much TV except for sport, server football. But she said, you know, the audition is then, would you like to do it? And I said, oh, sure, you know, why not? And it just went well. I mean, I guess it was just so.
Tell me what this show was, because.
Sure, I guess there was a comedian called Brian Connolly. I think it's sort of like Jimmy Kimmel or something like that. You know, and again, I'm not so familiar with those sorts of shows, but you know, it's a sort of like, you know, a late night or like an evening chat show, and it was called Brian Connolly's Crazy Christmas, and it was sort of like a Christmas special, and the part of the show I was involved in was they did this sort of medley of Christmas songs, and they had like a young child play with a little orchestra. They had like each carol, and they had a saxophonist, they had a flautist, they had a jazz piano who was a bit older, and I played the violin. So yeah, it was and you know, they gave you clothes and everything. Like, it was amazing. Like, you know, it was such a different sort of world. But I remember going there, and what I was wearing was, anyway, I thought I was smart, but they gave me this, they wanted me to dress a certain way. So I got like a red shirt and like some trousers and these, like, I think these Timberland sort of boots, and they said I could keep them afterwards. And that was just brilliant. So
the things that stick in the mind.
Oh, yeah.
After an experience when you were 9.
Yeah.
Wait, so how serious did the violin become for you?
Well, it was always what I wanted to do. I mean, you know, one never knows when you start a musical instrument at the very beginning, when you're a child, just how much work it's going to take. And I think if you did know that at the very beginning, it would be a real test of how much you love music. But the thing is, you've just got to be committed if you want to have opportunities to make music at higher and higher levels and reach more people and play to bigger audiences. You've got to improve, and that takes a lot of work.
This seems like the kind of thing where you would not have had a lot of time for additional hobbies, let alone an additional hobby that would require you to be like sort of, I don't know, a virtuoso, not just in music, but also in sports. And yet you picked up soccer at age 12. And I'm really curious about the story behind that.
Sure. Well, if I'm frightfully honest with you, Gina, I mean, it's very flattering to describe me as a virtuoso, but I can assure you, perhaps if I had dedicated 100% of my time to violin, I'd sort of be playing at a high level now. And I think that's probably true for anyone. There are many, many of my sort of colleagues and contemporaries at the educational institutions I was at who are far superior musicians. And so it's sort of like an onion, classical music. I mean, you know, you can get to one level, but there's always another level. There's always another level. And it's a lifetime of constant refinement. But for my sort of mentality, my mental state, my parents weren't musical at all. So I guess they were very happy for me to do the violin. But my father in particular, I guess, he always wanted to be a professional sportsman. I think his great regret was that he didn't play Australian rules football professionally. So that was really sort of his instigation. He really wanted me to do something active. And I think at the time I was getting a bit overweight. I mean, quite a lot overweight, actually. So, you know, it's time to sort of get off your backside and do something. And I was actually playing a lot of rugby all the way through elementary school and cricket. And I really loved those games. And for rugby, you know, you can carry a few pounds. That's sort of okay. But when I went to the music school, there was none of those sports. They didn't have anything. I mean, they had these great facilities, but obviously everyone was very concerned that they're going to break their fingers and ruin their careers, which, funnily enough, never went through my mind at all. And nobody was using these soccer fields, and so I just started playing soccer when I got there.
So there were empty soccer fields?
Oh, they were beautiful, yeah. I mean, there was this one that was very close to the practice rooms, and sort of, and there was another one that was a bit further away that was on a hill. But the one close to the practice rooms, everyone would sort of come and have lunch out by, and no one would, I mean, people would play occasionally, but it was just there, just unused.
But how did you play soccer by yourself?
Well, it's exactly the same. So I joined a team. I had no idea what I was doing. I was a rugby player, and I, you know, but I just, you know, wanted to do it. My father wanted me to do it. So it's just the same as violin. I mean, you just get some balls and you try to practice. You use resources that you can find and you try and improve yourself.
Okay, so the violin is not the only thing you play that I was once really bad at. Soccer also. And I had never played soccer before, and I attempted it in college. Not college, high school. And the thing that was really hard for me, not having really done a lot of sports stuff before, was that people, like in drills, there would be someone with the ball, and they'd come, or you know, you'd have the ball, someone would come toward you and try to get it. And if you aren't used to that kind of way of interacting with other people, it's very intimidating. And so it doesn't entirely seem to me that this is like the violin, because you don't just play soccer by yourself.
Well, the similarity lies in the process of improvement. Yes, it's a team game. And yes, you have to, you know, at the team practice, you have to practice coordinating with one another. But if you don't do any private practice, if you don't try to think about your personal game, and then you don't try to see how you can do things better, then you'll never progress, really. I always try to say to people who want to play, or the kids I coach occasionally, you know, you've got to make a difference when you're on the pitch, whatever position you're playing. And the level of influence you can have personally on a game as an individual is entirely down to your commitment and your technique, which is your ability to impact the game. And the good news is that anyone can do it. If you just have the resources, as in if you find the resources, especially now with the internet, it's very easy. There's a book by Pelé, which I found when I was trying to teach myself to improve and play, which is available for free online. And not many people know about it, but I just did a Google search when I was a bit younger, and I printed it off in the school IT room. I don't know if you remember those or if they had them in America, but this is before Wi-Fi and everything. You had to sort of go to the sort of internet cafe of the school and sign in and put your credits, and you know, it was such an archaic system. But yeah, I printed, it was like 60 or 70 double-sided pages, so I just did it when no one was looking, and he tells you everything. Like, from the very beginning.
So you can really just read how to play soccer?
Well, it's by Pelé. So, I mean, yeah, he sort of knew what he was doing. And the book is quite charming. It's very informative. And, you know, and it's very sweet. It's like, you know, if you don't have the money for a soccer ball, you know, you can use an orange or maybe even some rolled up firm paper. And I thought, well, there's no excuse. I mean, if the guy is trying to so much to show you how you can control the ball and juggle and move around, and he's trying to cater to everyone of all backgrounds, then try to follow his advice. And frankly, it really turned things around for me. And that's something that's been repeated throughout all of my life, not just with soccer, but music as well.
Well, were you, when you started, how did you start formally playing? Because you don't go from playing soccer by yourself from a book on an unused field at a music school to playing for a country. Well, it's without some in between.
It's, yeah, of course, no. So basically, you know, my father wanted me to play in a team. I had to join the lowest team in the lowest division that had the worst record because they were the only people that needed anyone. And even then, I remember coming to a training and the coach said, look, you know, I'm not sure that you're going to get much game time, but like, you know, we could use this as a sub occasionally. Is that okay with you? And I was, yeah, absolutely fine. But I made sure every single session that when I went there, and I, you know, at the beginning, I was quite overweight. Every single exercise the coach asked me to do, no matter how long it took me, I completed. So even when we had to run laps of the field, I would absolutely be last at the beginning, but I would do every single lap without stopping. And then people notice that eventually, and you also get better. It's not just a sort of favors thing. It's a general improvement.
That seems like a challenge to the ego in some ways.
Look, if there's one thing I've learned, if you want to change yourself and grow as a person and grow your ability at a certain skill, you have to have absolutely zero ego.
Keith Stanfield, Kansas City violinist. We will pick right back up with this conversation after the break, okay?
Okay.
So we will get from how Keith started out being on the worst team in the worst division to playing for Western Samoa after this break. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we're doing a portrait session today with Keith Stanfield. He is a violinist who has also played soccer at a very high level. Although the soccer did not get off to the most auspicious start, he was a music student who was using a field that his classmates were mostly taking advantage of just to eat lunch. And he taught himself from a book that he printed off of the internet when nobody was looking. So, Keith, we were just talking over the break that you haven't really shared this story with a lot of people before now.
No, you know, frankly, I haven't, precisely because it sounds totally ridiculous. I mean, when I just think to myself all of the experiences I've been sort of lucky enough to have of a completely different field, it really does sound silly. And, you know, even my wife, I actually met her after my soccer playing finished. So I've always been sort of sad that she sort of never really saw me in my sort of physical prime. But I'm taking steps to rectify this. But yeah, it's been interesting.
So where we left off, you were not in great shape and you were starting soccer sort of at your father's urging. And you got on the worst team in the worst division, but you made a commitment to every exercise that someone said it was time to do.
Yep.
It didn't matter how long it took you to do it, you were going to finish it. Basically, it sounds like you focused on discipline rather than on how good you actually were.
Well, it's funny you should say that. I think actually the one thing I've lacked for most of my life is discipline and routine. And it was a very important person in my life, one of my very influential violin teachers, actually, the Romanian soloist called Remus Azoite. He's a professor at the Royal Academy, excellent musician. And it was really him that was saying, you know, that the two ingredients to success at any skill are discipline and routine. And throughout my sort of domestic life, I hadn't had any of that at all.
Can but you I tell guess, me more about that?
Yeah, I mean, home was sort of, you know, without going into too much detail, it was sort of, frankly, a sort of chaotic place to live. And I left home when I was 16. But I guess in the case of soccer, all you can, you know, when you're the worst person in a group of people that are trying to do the same thing, to me, there's a huge incentive to improve. because, you know, you don't want to let people down. It's not necessarily because you want to do something for yourself. In a team exercise, you know, if you're the weakest link, you're sort of being a passenger, and it's best not to be a passenger if you can help it, I feel. So there's an obligation to others to sort of put your best foot forward. And so from that perspective, you know, when I was trying to do these exercises that I couldn't do, you know, my reception of the ball was terrible. You know, the only thing that allowed me to get a foot in at soccer at a late age, you know, I was 12, which is very late, was that I was a pretty good rugby player. And what I could do was kick the ball very, very far in the air, very accurately. And the first couple of times I did it, because I was so hopeless at everything else, coaches just assumed I was just, you know, kicking the ball and hoping that it would go somewhere. But, you know, when you play one 45-yard pass to someone's chest, that could be luck. Two, three, four, you know, please keep the ball on the ground. Stop doing that. The eighth time, they start to notice, well, it's going to someone's chest like every single time. And at that age in youth soccer, it's incredibly rare. I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen any sort of youth soccer matches, but if you can have a goalkeeper or a defender who takes free kicks and it goes more than 15 yards, that's brilliant. So that was I had one thing going for me, and that gave me a little inch, and I drove a bus through it eventually.
Well, so how are you? I have a couple of questions about this.
Sure.
One is where the motivation comes from when you're pursuing violin at the level that you are, like going to music school. The motivation to pursue soccer beyond a hobby. And then secondly, how you juggled these two things well enough that you pursued both essentially professionally.
Yeah, I sort of wish I could give you an answer, which was, well, you know, Gina, it was very simple. I did X, Y, and Z. I guess your life just gets compartmentalized, and now it's time for violin, so you think about violin, and now it's time for soccer, so you think about soccer. And again, you know, had I been more disciplined and had a better routine, I probably could have written everything out and sort of seen it, you know, all my activities on paper and sort of planned better and progressed even faster maybe, but... You know, it's time for this, so you've got to do it. And it's time for that, so you've got to do it. And that didn't go so well, so you've got to give this a bit more time. And, you know, I was terrible at balancing my preparation time. Yeah, you know, for a large part, for that part of my life. I mean, I think I didn't really have much of an example. And I don't mean that in any sort of pejorative sense. But, you know, things are what they are. And I guess I was just trying my best to be engaged to the utmost in whatever I was doing, whenever I was doing it.
How did you get noticed at soccer, like enough that you ended up playing for Western Samoa?
Well, Western Samoa is sort of fortunate. I mean, you know, fortunately, it's not the largest country in the world. But I was, you know, I was playing, you know, I worked hard at soccer and I ended up playing semi-professionally. And that sort of started just before I went to the academy and during.
To the Royal Academy of Music.
That's right, yeah. And to the conservatoire. Yeah, I was going to the junior. I think I ended up doing a lot of years at the academy from junior academy, you know, the Saturday school till graduation from the conservatoire. So I really know that building rather too well. But in any case, yeah, I was doing that. One never really knows sort of how these things happen, but I just got an email after a certain day when I was about 16 from this guy who was looking in Europe for players, and it was all rather sort of surreal, and so I responded, and then they had some sort of training camps in Europe where we played against European professional academy sides, all in Germany, and those games went very well. It was interesting, you know, because you think of Western Samoa, and it's a very proud, beautiful place. I don't know if you've seen Moana, the film.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically 100% accurate. It's very sweet. And it was actually very nostalgic watching that with my son, because I haven't been there in a while. And it gave a very good flavor of what life and islanders are like, even though it was a cartoon.
But it was beautiful.
Yes, and it is. And it's very simple and sort of and sweet in that sense. But... You know, you don't think of them and you don't think international soccer powerhouse. I was really shocked the first training session I went to. I mean, all of the players could play. They were just very short.
But wait, so, but how, you got an email and that was
I just got an email from this scout who was saying, yeah, you know, I noticed that you have nationality. You know, I noticed you play soccer. I saw this game. Would you please, you know, put yourself for consideration for this squad? You come here? And
well, what did you think of that? Because first of all, you've grown up in the UK your whole life, and your mom was from Western Samoa, but how much did you know about this place? Did you feel a connection to it?
Yeah, I'd been there many times as a child, fortunately, yeah. And at times for quite a long time.
What did it mean to you?
I thought it would make my parents very happy, particularly my father at the time. At that time, we had a very, very good relationship. And you know, this is something that he really wanted me to do. And so I guess, really, I mean, that's like when I, now that I talk it through with you, I think that was really what was going on. You know, I was asked to do something, and I've noticed sort of a difference between sort of American parenting and the sort of English parenting, or the, I guess, the Polynesian Antipodean parenting that I went through. Is, I think there's, and I'm not saying one is better or worse, but there's a lot of sort of parenting by negotiation in America. You know, there's sort of like, we have a roundtable discussion about what activity you should do, and then we'll make a family joint decision democratically as to what is going to happen at 7 p.m. Whereas in my house, it was like, okay, today you will do this, and this will happen at this time. And, you know, there should be no questions. And that was just sort of my reality. And so when I got this email, I guess it was sort of surreal. I mean, you know, almost seems like a sort of practical joke. But again, it's, none of these things are really that big of a deal. You just take it in your stride and take the opportunity and go from there.
Did you worry about what would happen to music?
No, because I wasn't thinking properly. No, you know, it's, again, it's the sort of compartmentalization of one's life and trying to...
And being 16?
Yeah, sort of. Yeah, you know, I mean, but you're not very experienced. Yeah, you sort of don't really understand what things take.
So you get to Western Samoa, a place that you've been before throughout your childhood, but this time to play professional soccer. What does happen to music during this time?
You've got to practice as often as you can, when you can, and it's, you know, you're the only one doing that activity outside of the training time. And obviously there are no dedicated facilities. It's a third world country. And that was actually something going to Samoa as an older person rather than as a child, and not staying with family. You have to stay in the sort of the training complex. It was quite saddening. So, like I said, the only place I could practice was that abattoir with the pigs.
So for listeners who have just tuned in, tell that story.
Well, I remember we had the first qualification match coming up, and we were training for this game against Vanuatu. And Vanuatu, incidentally, is another small island, but it was a French colony. So although it's a small island, everyone who couldn't make it into the French national team were playing in this team. So we were playing as professionals. And these guys were 6'7", 6'6", you know, they look like real specimens. Whereas the average height of a Samoan is sort of about my height, which is on a good day, 6 foot.
On a good day. What is it on a normal day?
It's sort of probably closer to 5'10.5", that half being very important. but yes, so I remember it was like very hot. We were practicing at the hottest point of the day, which I hope it's not too much of an embarrassment, but I thought that was insane because the game is at night. Anyway, and we were practicing these exercises where someone would run down the wing and cross the ball into one of our forwards who would try and head the ball into the goal. Now, how we were supposed to do that, playing against real professionals who are considerably taller and, you know, get paid a lot to do this for a living, was anyone's guess, you know. But, I mean, coaches have their reasons for sort of doing things. So there was this, you know, it was already tiresome and hot and frustrating and sort of, you know, many of us sort of felt that we didn't really understand why we were doing this. But the training was 3 hours long, and then we'd go and rest, and we'd have another session in the sort of afternoon. So after this incredibly tiring, sweaty, arduous training session, I'd go back, change, take my violin, to the shed that no one was using and begin. It was actually the Brahms Violin Concerto I started to learn. And yeah, you'd look around and try and learn the opening, and there are sort of pigs on hooks everywhere.
Why was there a like shed / slaughterhouse?
Well, again, it's a third world country, and so a lot of the infrastructure. I mean, and one of the sad things for me was that we were getting a lot of sort of privileges that other islanders weren't getting.
As people on
as
the soccer
players.
Team?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it wasn't like, you know, Real Madrid level of things, but I mean, we had this little campus and complex, and you go into the main town, and then there were sort of unaccompanied five-year-olds trying to sell popcorn. And that was a really sort of sobering thing for me to witness as an older person that I probably hadn't understood as a younger person.
By older, you mean 16 years old?
Yeah.
Okay, well, go on.
So basically, you know, I mean, they don't have a lot of refrigeration there, and you know, it's sort of very agrarian society, and these pigs were going to be sort of consumed that evening, and they were, you know, it wasn't like a sort of slaughterhouse like Tyson Chicken or something. It was, you know, it was just, we're going to need to eat pork tonight. Okay, so kill that pig, prepare it, and we'll sort of roast it in the evening.
Did you have to, like, ask someone permission to use this shed to be practicing the violin?
You know, I can't really remember, but I knew I had to practice. So, you know, just find whatever works and ask for forgiveness, not for permission.
This is going to maybe sound like a crazy question, but did you enjoy playing the violin in that setting and in that context? I mean, it sounds like such a, in some ways, really a break from the other activity.
Well, frankly, yeah. I mean, I knew I had work to do on the instrument. I was learning for the first time a piece that I really, really loved, and that spoke to me sort of artistically and sort of emotionally a lot. And no, it was a very unsatisfying experience, funnily enough, to have to practice in these sort of conditions. And that's why I quit soccer.
Because you didn't want to have to practice that way anymore?
Well, I was in my third year at the academy, and here I was, you know, playing soccer 36 hours away from home, from London, and trying to play the violin in this shed with dead pigs. And I thought, you know, this isn't how it's supposed to be. So, you know, I also realized that it was that moment. And then I think in a subsequent training session, I realized I was running around trying to make some tackles. And I just realized I wasn't doing it properly because I, you know, my heart wasn't in it. So that made the decision for me.
Well, Keith Stanfield, we are going to be getting right back to this conversation. Stick around with me, okay?
Mm-hmm.
When we return, we'll find out what Keith is doing in Kansas City and how a chance encounter here reunited him with his violin after a strange hiatus. That's still to come on KCUR's Central Standard. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and today's show is a portrait session with Keith Stanfield, who is a violinist here in Kansas City, who's had a story. He's lived a story that even sounds sort of ridiculous to him, as he was just telling us earlier. He is both a professional violinist, and he has played on the World Cup qualifying team for Western Samoa in soccer. And Keith was just telling us why he quit soccer, that he was practicing violin by himself in a shed surrounded by pig carcasses. And also that soccer wasn't really what he wanted to do. But Keith, you know, what strikes me is that the age that you're talking about, you're around 16. Most people at that age are figuring out what it is they want versus what other people have always told them they should expect of themselves. And it sounds like soccer was always kind of your dad's dream. And you went to another country and into some pretty extreme circumstances to come to terms with the fact that it wasn't yours.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I mean, some relationships are very important to you. And, you know, I think all of us would do whatever it took to sort of, or whatever we could to maintain them.
So when you quit soccer, what then? How did you move forward?
Very easily. I didn't have to go to the gym twice a day anymore. It was brilliant. And I also just completely stopped watching soccer. Like, by that stage, it was very pressurized and, you know, if I'm honest, like, it was very difficult for me to enjoy any time on a soccer field. It was very intentional. It was a job. And I say it was a job in sort of a negative sense, as if we're all supposed to not enjoy what we're doing. But, it was almost like a judgment or a punishment, like I was serving some kind of sentence. And, it was sort of, I guess it was liberating to realize that it didn't have to be that way.
So what did you do next? How did you...
Well, I finished off my time at the academy, and then I started playing more concerts and pursuing the sort of musical life.
What brought you to Kansas City?
That's funny. Well, my wife, who I actually met at the Royal Academy of Music, who's actually from Prairie Village, Kansas, we met there and got married in London. We had a lecture together, and funnily enough, it was actually the sound of her voice that she used to sit in the back row. The class was called Musical Aesthetics and Criticism. And if there's one thing I love, Gina, it's criticizing. It's absolutely fantastic. It's very cathartic and very enjoyable. I mean, privately, but it's something I'm working on. But it can be absolutely enjoyable to sort of, because as classical musicians, we spend our whole lives picking ourselves apart. So when you see a TV show or something like that, or a sports match, it's wonderful to pass some of that on to something else.
To share the wealth.
So yes, exactly. And I used to sit in the front row by myself, I think, for various reasons. And there always used to be this wonderful sort of American accent coming from the back row. And it was just very charming and very calming and sort of beautiful. And that was my wife, Ashley. And so we met there, fast forward some years. We got married and we were living in London. She got an opportunity as an adjunct professor of viola at Drake University in Iowa. And, we thought it would be sort of a good opportunity to move over. And I thought it'd be nice to live in a different country and open up a new chapter.
And that experience at Drake somehow also ultimately ended up bringing you to Kansas City?
Well, we actually lived at Kansas City the whole time. She commuted.
Oh, okay.
Which is a very long commute.
Yeah, from one state to another.
Yeah, it's a good many hours in a car.
And so what about you and your musical career in the midst of all of this?
Well, I was sort of applying for a job here, actually, at the same time as I was going to be here. That the application process lasted quite some time. And I was, assisting my professor at the academy. And it was sort of something similar over here. And it was a little bit of a long shot. But, I was in the running and went through many series of interviews. And ultimately, it sort of fell through after, 9 or 11 months. And having quit soccer and committed to this and tried very hard to sort of get things going, I was very crushed by this. And I just decided, that I was done. That was it. I'm not going to play the violin anymore. I'm going to try something else completely different. I'd always thought, just idly, despite the fact that I didn't have an MBA or any financial background whatsoever, that I could sort of do something in business. So I thought coming to America, I could set that part of my life aside. It was a new country, new life, new place. Let's just try something different. And so I just, I still taught and I didn't play any concerts, didn't do anything. And I didn't basically play my violin hardly at all.
How long did this last?
Oh, geez. 2 or 3 years, I think.
Maybe so two. Before we move on to how you reunited with the violin, I mean, how much had your violin career advanced in the time between giving up soccer and coming to America?
Reasonably well. I was doing a lot of sort of recitals. There's a little sort of unofficial circuit of private recitals that you can do around Europe. It's not any official thing, You do one, you get another. You do one.
Private recitals for?
Well, sort of, I guess aristocrats or people of that sort of class, for want of a better phrase, enjoy having private concerts for their friends that they're willing to pay for.
And at their houses?
Yes. Yeah. They're very large houses. so it's sort of a little more imaginable when you take, it's not like having a concert in my house or something. No, they have very substantial houses. And, you can sort of hop around there and teach a bit and.
So it was on track.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
And that's a lot, though, riding on one job opportunity. It's just that you had committed to Kansas City and...
It wasn't the job opportunity. It was just, I've been playing since I was three, and I've been going through the whole education, musical educational system without a break. And I hadn't really at any point said as a more mature adult, is this something I want to commit my life to? It was just, I have to do it. And that experience was the sort of straw that broke the camel's back. I was like, this is just not worth the sort of the supplication and the sort of the hard work that I felt was I was putting in.
And so how did those few years away from the violin feel to you?
Well, I didn't know what I'd missed until I started again. They were brilliant at first. I mean, I tell you something, in many ways, business is way harder work than practicing an instrument. I mean, I know many of us, you know, practice a lot of hours in the day, but you're accountable to yourself, ultimately. When you're accountable to someone else in a sort of corporate structure, you have to work. I just feel it's a lot more demanding. And it can be very rewarding, but it's a different discipline, but it's very regimented. But it really did inform when I came back to violin how to work and how to practice, and that experience has been really invaluable.
How did you end up coming back? Violin doesn't... The way that I've watched people who are professional musicians work, it doesn't seem like stepping away for a couple of years that you necessarily could come back.
No, nothing is guaranteed in this field at all, with any skill. So what happened was, my wife was playing in this orchestra to make friends, and it was conducted by a guy called Chris Keltz, who's really a fantastic musician, great conductor, and has become a very good friend, but very talented guy. And he was looking for extra violinists for this project, he mentioned, and my wife happened to mention that I play the violin, and he was sort of very interested in that. And, you know, he said, where did he study? I said, oh, I went to the Royal Academy of Music. And he was really keen to get me there. And, you know, I said, okay, fine, you know, I'll be happy to do it. But, you know, I haven't played in a very, very long time. And, you know, I'm sort of down about the whole thing. But if you really need help, I'll do it. So what are we playing? And it was a Beethoven's Seventh Symphony. Now, the sort of funny thing was, the first time I ever played in a symphony orchestra, I couldn't sight read. The Suzuki method's great at teaching to play from the heart and to play without notes, but my sight reading was absolutely awful. And so I had to play, you know, I was a child. I had to play Beethoven 7. I couldn't read any of the music. It was the second violin. It was so embarrassing. I had to go and get a recording and listen for the second violin part and learn it all by ear because I couldn't read fast enough any of the notes. So there was a nice little symmetry there that I had to play this piece, and it was the same part. And I thought, you know what? Fine, I will do it. But this time I'm really going to play like every single note really properly to right this sort of wrong of my past. And it was such an enjoyable musical experience, both with the music and with him as a director, that made me sort of really realize, you know, this is what I really should be doing.
What was so amazing about that musical experience? Was it that it was a reunion with the instrument after so long, or was there something else?
It's music making in a group. That's what it is. It's the magic of making music with people that you like and doing it quite nicely. It really gives you goosebumps and gives you a great euphoric sort of feeling when things go well.
We're listening to a recording now of you playing a sonata. Mm-hmm. Tell me about it.
This is Brahms' second sonata in A major, the finale. It's a really lovely piece and one that's I really like playing.
So you're still playing now, today, in Kansas City?
That's right, yeah.
Tell me about what you're doing.
Well, I just finished doing the Brahms Violin Concerto with the Kansas City Civic Orchestra. I'm doing the Four Seasons, all of them, with this Westwood Ensemble in February. And actually in Easter, I've convinced my old childhood friend to come and do a series of Brahms sonatas over 3 weeks. She's a fantastic pianist, and I'm really looking forward to that.
Keith Stanfield, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
This has been a portrait session, which means you'll see a write-up of Keith's story with photographs by Paul Andrews online in the coming days at kcur.org/centralstandard. While you're there, check out some of the great conversations we've had throughout the week, including our talk with bioethics pioneer Maya Christopher, our conversation about women trying to break into the world of classical music composition, and we checked in on our neighbors in St. Louis as protests there continue. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Tom Taylor. Paul Andrews is our portrait session partner. Our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. Linda Scher runs the board. I'm Gina Kaufman.